From the Sky News Centre at 5, a huge bomb's exploded near government headquarters in Oslo, killing and injuring several people. Police in Norway say the blast struck a busy part of the capital earlier this afternoon, throwing debris onto the streets and sending people running for cover. It's thought the blast was caused by a car bomb, although no one's admitted carrying out the attack. Reporter Oscar Ulund says it appears the target was the heart of Norway's government.
It was a massive explosion, all the windows came flying out and the government building was the most damaged. From the looks of the building and the rush of ambulances, I believe there are people who are injured.
James Murdoch is under pressure over claims he misled MPs over the phone hacking scandal. The Prime Minister insists the media tycoon has questions to answer about what he knew and when he knew it. A man who stabbed and killed a burglar in his own home has been told he won't face charges. Peter Flanagan was bailed last month after being questioned over the stabbing of an intruder at his home in Salford. 27-year-old John Bennell died after being knifed in the chest. Nazir Afzal from the Crown Prosecution Service says people are entitled to use reasonable force to protect themselves.
All the evidence indicates to me that in the frightening circumstances that Mr. Flanagan faced, he did what he honestly and instinctively believed to be necessary to protect himself and his home.
Energy Secretary Chris Huhne has been questioned for a second time over claims that he made his ex-wife take speeding points for him. Vicky Price was also interviewed by police in Essex on Wednesday regarding the allegation. Figures from the Ministry of Justice show the prison population in England and Wales has reached a record high. More than 85,000 prisoners are currently behind bars. And it's been a good day for England's batsmen against India in the first test at Lord's. They've moved on to 363 for 5 in their first innings, helped by Kevin Peterson's unbeaten century. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review the news this week is Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After 6 o'clock news, with the death on Monday of Sean Hoare, the key witness against the Prime Minister's former press secretary Andy Coulson, we ask, is there a Murdoch death squad stalking Britain? We look at a host of suspicious deaths and ask a West Country doctor his expert opinion, asking how easy is it to kill someone and make it look like an accident or suicide? And the euro crisis is solved by quantitative easing, but is this just making the crash worse when it finally does happen? Plus, as the phone hacking story unfolds daily, we ask how alleged criminal mastermind Andy Coulson ended up as Downing Street press secretary. We look also at Murdoch's parroting of Israeli policies and hear the latest analysis from Nick Davis, the journalist that originally unearthed the phone hacking scandal for The Guardian. That's in the second hour, after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, there's a little light rain possible this weekend, 17 Celsius, sunny periods, and more sun, though, on Sunday this weekend. Light wind, maybe some also a little bit of light rain across the weekend. Next week, it's around 20 Celsius, rising in temperature through the week. Sunny with occasional light rain. Some days will be sunny periods, but mostly sunny. Next weekend, it's the 30th and 31st of July. Well, cold, 11 degrees Celsius at the maximum. Persistent rain from Saturday afternoon, according to the forecast, and on through the weekend. So come on, summer, where are you? The week after next, that's that's just the first week in August, cold and sunny periods. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guest, and joining us is Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi there. Thank you very much.
Now, first of all, you're a Conservative Councillor. Why the Conservative Councillor and not one of the other parties?
Well, there are those that would say that the other parties wouldn't have me, but I'm sure that's not true. I'm sure they'd love to have me. But the Conservatives got to me first, so I suppose that's why I'm a Conservative.
So the Conservatives came and found you. You didn't go and look for them?
Well, of course they would do. They would come and look for me, wouldn't they?
So, OK, so what's why is it then, ideologically, that you prefer Conservative rather than Lib Dem or Labour or one of the, or even the Green Party?
I suppose it's really because I feel that the Conservative Party probably best represents my views. I wouldn't say that I agreed with everything that the Conservative Party stand for, but I probably disagree with them less than I do the other parties.
Now, that's all very well here in Bristol. What about up in London too? Do you think that there's the same kind of ideology in the Conservative Party here in Bristol and up at Westminster?
I doubt it very much. They've got a different job to do in Westminster to the job that has to be done locally. And a lot of people confuse the two and think that the two are very, very close together. But in fact, they're considerable distance apart. So it's not really fair to compare Westminster politicians with local politicians.
Okay, so what's your role now on the City Council? I think you're chairing something now. What did you say just now?
Yes, I chair the DC North, which is the Northern Area Planning Committee, and I serve on some of the scrutiny committees as well, the Health and Adult Community Care and also Community Cohesion.
Now, many people will have heard your name through the connection with Shirley Brown, the Liberal Democrat, the first ever black woman councillor on the City Council, through you are allegedly, anyway, reporting her to the police. Now, can you just explain your role in that whole business and why you decided to do that?
Well, I'll say what I said in court when I was asked a very similar question, why I did this, and it's because I'm old enough to remember the 70s when there were the race riots in St Paul's. I ran my own business at that time and I employed a number of people from the area. I had to give first aid to some of my staff who had been attacked, and they'd been attacked by people from their own background, if you like, mainly younger people. It was a terrible time. It was a no-go area there, and I was just appalled that the city in which I was born could have sunk to such desperate levels, and I just felt that the sort of behaviour from Shirley Brown was likely to cause that rather than help it at all.
But don't you think that the language she was using, this word coconut, was actually the idea being really to appeal to people in St Paul's and people of her own race particularly, who would understand exactly what such sort of terminology would mean?
Well, I'm sure if I'd said a similar thing, I would have been held up not only to ridicule, I'd probably been prosecuted as well, and rightly so.
Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, is joining us too. Martin, this week we hear crisis again. It's almost like every week there's another crisis, whether it's Portugal, Greece, Ireland or wherever. It never goes away, this, does it? But it looks like the heads of government meeting yesterday have decided to do quantitative easing for Europe. Is that going to work or is it just putting off the inevitable?
I'm afraid it's just putting off the inevitable. Well, they didn't really have much choice because the alternative was to allow the banks to collapse, which they will in the end anyway.
But isn't that what you would like them to do?
No. I mean, the problem is, you know, as the old joke says, the old Irish joke says, if we're going to bring in this these kind of stereotypes, as it were, is if I were you, I wouldn't start from here. And we've got ourselves into a hell of a mess here. And there are no good options.
But isn't one of your solutions to this, when you actually a bank does go bankrupt, the best thing is to allow it to go bankrupt and then take it over for free?
Well, what should have happened over the last 2 years since the Lehman Brothers collapse is that basically the state has stepped in and propped up the banking system, but there's been a denial of the fact that that's what's happened, and we're all talking about when we get back to normal of having normal private banking, but that isn't going to happen. But the state hasn't fulfilled its responsibilities. They've chucked money at the problem, but they've not taken control of the problem. And effectively what happened yesterday was the banks in the City of London and Frankfurt and Paris dictated to the EU political leadership what to do, and after much kicking and screaming, they did as they were told, because the alternative was a meltdown.
But it sounds to me like you're resigned to the fact that our elected politicians aren't really in charge, the banks are.
Well, I'm afraid that's the situation we're in. I mean, what should have happened when Obama got elected was, if he was like Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 30s, he would have taken control of the situation. Roosevelt basically, you know, kicked the banks into shape in the 30s because he had the political power to do it. Yeah, it was like trade union votes that had got him there, and the money that behind him wasn't Wall Street money. And he said at one stage, Wall Street hates me and I welcome their hatred. Whereas Obama's attitude has been funded by Wall Street, has been to basically appease them. And that really was the chance that we had to do something, and we've missed it, sadly.
Is there anybody in the British current political establishment you think that is prepared to stand up to the banks? So what about King Mervyn?
Well, Mervyn King obviously has said some interesting things during the crisis. Like, he's raised questions about fractional reserve banking as a whole and said, maybe we need to look at this.
Maybe the system's wrong.
You've got to think about what Mervyn King's background is. He's a career civil servant with a background in academic economics. So he's a bit of an outsider, which isn't a good thing in a central bank governor, I think, actually. I mean, Ben Bernanke, who runs the Federal Reserve, is basically a banker who's running the Federal Reserve, and Mervyn King comes from outside that loop. And if you're going to have somebody regulating something, it's often useful to have them from a completely different, you know, he's not going to go and work in a bank when he finishes, and he's never worked in a bank apart from the Bank of England. And that's the tradition in Britain, is having career civil servants who are independent. And I actually think that's quite good. I mean, everything in the US is totally super politicised, and the appointees are all political insiders, and often insiders in Wall Street as well. So it's a revolving door, and so that's the problem.
I'm not sure. I can't necessarily see what you see as a way out of this, because a general election.
What should happen is, if the state, which basically Germany has agreed that the European Central Bank refused to print money directly. Germany, Angela Merkel has been dragged kicking and screaming forward to say that she will pledge the German budget to underpin the euro. But that basically is the German taxpayer doing that. Now, if the taxpayer is going to underpin the system, the taxpayer and the taxpayer's representatives, let's say the politicians, should have control over what's going on. They should be telling the banks what to do. But, of course, the shoe is on the other foot. And this is the problem all along. And the more money the banks are given through these bailouts, they then use this money to lobby the politicians for more money. It's what Milton Friedman called... I can't remember what he called it. But the idea is that once the state funds something, that becomes a vested interest, which then demands more money from the state, and it just gets on and on and on. And people used to talk about this as being, you know, nationalised industries being an endless hole for money. Well, the banking system has become an endless hole for money. I think what they should have done is basically, once you've propped the banking system up to stop it collapsing, you basically need to then dismantle it. Yeah. So instead of blowing the building up, as it were, you take it down brick by brick, and the existing management all have to go. I mean, that's what happens in other parts of industry, isn't it? The existing managers have to go, and you rebuild from scratch.
Yeah, so Chris, what's your take on all this? You know, many people think of the Conservatives as sort of business people that understand these sort of financial money issues, and maybe that's why they managed to get quite a lot of people to vote for your party, is actually the thought that, oh, it's what we need is a safe pair of business hands on the levers because we're having financial trouble.
Well, I think there is some merit in that thought, in as much as if we look back over the last... 14 years, I think what's happened in this country to the banks, to the value of the pound, to our reserves, seems to indicate that perhaps Conservatives are better at managing money than our previous
government.
But at
the time of the last election, last year, the economy was starting to pick up a little bit, and one of the first things that George Osborne did was to raise VAT and actually to slow down consumer spending. Now things are looking rather shaky, and certainly inflation is on the way up. I mean, I think I'm not really interested in you talking about, oh, is this all the fault of the previous government, because the Conservatives have had, not quite 18 months, but about, what is it, 15 months?
It's less than a year.
Yeah. To actually put the economy right, and it's still not happened.
Well, I think you need to leave it a bit longer than 18 months before you draw comparisons. I think if you were to ask me in 10 years' time, I'd be able to give you an accurate answer. But at this moment in time, we're still trying to pick up the pieces. And quite honest, to go back to your original question, which was about what's happened with the bailout for Greece, etc., I see the real problem as a euro. Because it stops individual countries who have their own individual problems from devaluing, perhaps. They can't do that. They're stuck with the euro, and thank goodness we haven't got the euro.
I see you nodding there, Martin. And Peter Oborne in today's Telegraph is saying the euro crisis will give Germany the empire it's always dreamed of.
Well, I mean, this sort of talk, I mean, Germany basically has been made, German taxpayer has been put on the hook for all the money that's gone missing, as it were. That's not really much of an empire, is it? It's an empire of debt. They're not achieving, but I mean, and of course, I mean, the debate has been framed in the wrong way, talking about the Greeks being bailed out. It's the German and French and British banks with the collateralised debt obligations have been bailed out. The Greeks won't see a penny of this money, and it's not enough. Because it's only just about Greece. We've got Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and possibly France to go. What they're doing is kicking the can down the road, because that's all they can do.
With this quantitative easing. Yeah. I mean, they can continually do that, though, surely. That's,
no, no, because at a certain point, at a certain point, you can't, because then the euro is devalued to pieces, and the same thing's going to happen with the dollar. We've now got this game of chicken going on between Obama and the Republicans in the US about passing a budget.
I mean, call me cynical, but have they just called this thing quantitative easing? Because years ago, the whole idea of printing money was discredited, so they had to come up with a new term.
Basically, yes. Mm. But I mean, the fact is, you see, people say, well, you shouldn't print money. I mean, it's the old, if the alternative is you know, swift death, then of course you take the alternative. You know, you take what the pills that you're offered. And the problem is that we're getting to a situation where the options are getting narrower and narrower and narrower. And what may happen in the end, and this is very scary, is we'll have a hyperinflationary depression, which is very rare. The only example I can think of is the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, when inflation went up over 1,000% and everybody lost their jobs and didn't have any money simultaneously. So that's much worse than the 30s. It's a real shock. And that could happen. If the dollar goes down, there's massive overhang of dollars all over the world. They will all come shooting back to the United States when everybody dumps them, and it'll massively push up the price level inside the United States, even as the economy collapses. And okay. That's pretty scary, because unlike the former Soviet Union, the people in America are armed to the teeth.
Okay, so I think what for a lot of people, what they want to know is if they've got savings or if they've got debt. One by one, can you just tell us what's the best thing to do if you've got savings, and what's the best thing to do if you've got debt at the moment?
If you've got savings, you should buy gold, basically.
And if you've got debt, is there any way you can get out of debt?
Well, actually, if you're a standard ordinary debtor, as many of us are, you can go and get advice about having your debts written down, and you should. Once you find yourself in trouble with debt, don't wait. Go and ask for help, because I used to work for Bristol Debt Advice Centre. The help is there. Yeah, I mean, people I know have declared themselves bankrupt, which is a bit of a trauma, but it's much better than trying to pay unpayable debt.
So is it possible just to go bankrupt and start again from scratch?
It is, if your debts are bad enough. Yeah? In America, it's a normal practice, and many people do it. It's just unusual here. But you know, in other parts, in the US, people can be declared bankrupt several times and then come back and be a super businessman at the end of it. You know,
Conservative councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows, I'm going to give the final word to you. Tell us that the Conservatives are going to actually sort this problem out, because now the ball is in your court.
Yes, I think they are going to sort it out. They've done it before. I think that we'll do it again. I have every confidence that they will sort it out. But I also have every confidence that it's going to be a hard struggle for everybody, and some people even more than others.
Okay, on to our next story, and no surprises, James Murdoch groomed for the top, but now looking down the barrel. This is Owen Gibson in The Guardian today. He will be unable to avoid another round of allegations and recriminations. This is James Murdoch, guaranteed to keep him in the headlines. It's like the last scene from Reservoir Dogs, when they all shoot each other, but what did the Murdochs expect? After dumping on so many News International executives and laying off hundreds of journalists when they impetuously shut down the News of the World in a bid to contain the scandal, the only surprise that the shots weren't fired sooner. The question is now, who's going to be the last man standing? The newspaper paper empire Rupert Murdoch built up over the last four decades, and will his son and heir apparent James be among them? The bombshell two-paragraph statement by the News of the World's former editor and legal affairs manager is threatening to finish off James Murdoch's career, just as he might have thought he'd emerged from the worst. On Tuesday, he would have gone to bed pleased with his polished performance at the Culture Select Committee, but as a result of the statement, Murdoch's now being accused of the very willful blindness that he claimed not to have heard of on Tuesday. Basically, what's happened is certain people are now saying that statements that he made on Tuesday are literally quite wrong. Lies, in fact. That's the accusation. Martin, do you want to pick up on this?
Well, yes. I mean, I even when I watched the whole pantomime on Tuesday, and it was quite obvious to most people who were watching that there were a lot of lies were being told. This sort of "I didn't know it, know anything" from James and Rupert Murdoch, who are famously hands-on managers, both of them, and apparently they knew nothing about anything. That was incredibly implausible, and of course they dumped it all on their subordinates. And the first thing their subordinates are going to say, "Well, no, we didn't do it all. They were in on it all the way," which was always going to happen.
Chris, did you watch any of this or listen to it on the radio on Tuesday?
Yes, I did. All I can say is that the expression comes to mind, those that sup with the devil should use a long spoon, and in this case I don't think the spoon's anywhere near long enough.
So has David Cameron been supping with the devil with having Andy Coulson in such a key position in Downing Street?
He has suffered a backlash from this, but it's very, very difficult when you're in such a high profile position as he is, not to escape on occasions being perhaps implicated the wrong word, but perhaps associated with the wrongdoing of others.
Well, one person that had some things to say about Tuesday's performance by James and Rupert Murdoch particularly was the editor of Newsweek, Tina Brown, and she spoke to Gavin Esler on Wednesday's Newsnight programme.
One of the most humorous things to me was the way neither Rupert, James or Rebecca seemed to have any knowledge of who it was who signed these checks, who directed these checks to be signed, which just didn't seem credible to me. It is obviously the most kind of evil-smelling aspect of this case that Mulcair, the hackers, continued to have their legal fees paid after doing something which they claim to be so abhorrent. I mean, after all, it was Mulcair who was hacking into the phone of Millie Dowler. So on the one hand, they're saying this is abhorrent. On the other hand, they're paying this abhorrent personage's legal fees still. So that seemed to me to be the most kind of rich area of obvious weakness in their case.
What about the general principle of "I didn't know, I didn't ask, I wasn't told, it was just a small part of my business"?
Well, it is odd to me, only that he does remain very interested in stories, and it is the fun part, in a sense, of his life. And when he, I think Philip Davis said, you know, "What do you say when you call the News of the World editor? Do you call him?" He said, "Yes, I often call him on a Saturday night," and he'd say, "I'd say, what's doing? You know, have you got a good story for tomorrow?" Well, actually, the truth is, the next question he would normally ask is, "How did you get it?" Because Rupert actually is interested in the process of journalism. So to me, it doesn't ring true at all that he was such a kind of clueless sort of aging monarch who at this point has no interest. He actually is very interested in stories, how they're got, who they're doing over, and, you know, what was the method of getting them. He's interested in that stuff, so that surprised me.
That was Tina Brown, who's the editor of Newsweek, speaking on Newsnight. So Martin, is it really possible that James or Rupert nor Rebecca actually knew who was signing checks for these people?
I don't think so, and I think that they are going to regret telling fibs to the House of Commons. It's a criminal offence to lie to these committees. It's going to be proved over the next day or so that they were lying, and then of course it just all gets worse and worse for them, doesn't it?
That's right. It could even be worse. If, see, the thing is, you've got contempt as well as the original offence,
yes,
and that's an extra 10 years potentially. Chris, what are your thoughts about this? Is this exposing a sort of bigger problem, do you think?
Yes, I think that for a number of years now, more and more power has been sort of taken by the big nationals and internationals, and I think this was bound to happen sooner or later, but that it should have happened as a result of the disgraceful, most unacceptable face of journalism is a terrible, terrible shame. Newspapers, along with the other media, do have an important part to play in our lives. But then when they're dragged down into the muck, as they have been, people just don't know what to believe. People will not believe what's in the newspapers anymore, which is doing nobody any good.
Well, that's one thing that Martin Bell, the former BBC reporter, said last week as well. This whole idea of Murdoch leading a kind of race to the bottom in national news.
We are witnessing the end of what I call the Murdochracy. You know, 30 years in which journalists have been cutting corners for profit, for whatever motive. I think in recent weeks people have woken up to the fallibility of journalism, especially in its ethical dimension. you know, for years we don't believe everything we read, everything we see, but we prefer to suppose it was gathered by honest means. Now we have a series of events: the retreat of the Murdoch Empire, the disgrace of its hacking methods, and there may be other papers involved. We have the Independent suspending its star columnist over accusations of plagiarism. And what I've added to the mix was some recollections from my long time in television news that broadcast journalism is not exempt. Indeed, it attracts those kinds of driven and ruthless people who believe they can succeed at each other's expense, much like politics, actually. And I do know, and I have detailed in the past, some of the things that happen. Reporters pretending to be where they are not. Reporters fiddling with soundtracks, especially what we call in television the bang bang, making it more exciting. This can be and has been cosmetically added on. Reporters showing a reconstruction as the real thing. This is notoriously what happened with James Forlong, a tragic case, the Sky News defense correspondent who took his own life after he was exposed for just such a fraud. And I'm increasingly doubtful at some of the things I see on television news.
That was Martin Bell speaking earlier this week, and interesting to learn that Sean Hoare is not the first, at least a suspicious death at the part of the Murdoch Empire. He's talking there about James Furlong, who committed suicide in 2003 as an ex-Sky News reporter. But Chris, what can we do to stop this race to the bottom? And as Martin was just talking about there, the idea that there's nobody actually going to check up on journalists if they falsify soundtracks, say they are in a part of the world where they're not necessarily even there, but there's nobody actually, it seems, prepared to check up on this.
Well, the problem is that there will always be a small percentage of the reading public, if you like, that like to read the most salacious stories about well-known people. So there's always going to be a market for that type of newspaper, and newspapers need to get circulation, and they need to produce copy which is going to sell the newspapers. And unless there is a stronger legal challenge to some of these things, then it's going to continue. It may be a different name. I'm sure it will be a different name in this case, but it will still happen. It's down to the public to demand what they want from journalism.
But the public aren't in a position to demand. They're just handed something on a newsstand and they pick it up or they don't. The public aren't in a position to say, I want that story changed, are they?
Well, there's only one way that they can exercise any control, and that's by refusing to buy the newspapers.
Well, one person who exercised his control in a certain way is the journalist Robert Fisk, who was writing in The Independent last weekend, described why he would not ever work again with Rupert Murdoch. He said, "The end came for me when I flew to Dubai in 1988 after the USS Vincennes had shot down an Iranian passenger airliner over the Gulf. Within 24 hours, I'd spoken to the British air traffic controllers at Dubai, discovered that the US ships had routinely been threatening British Airways airliners, and that the crew of the Vincennes appeared to have panicked. The foreign desk told me the report was up for the page one splash. I warned them the American leaks that the Iran Air plot was trying to suicide crash his aircraft onto the Vincennes were rubbish, and they agreed. But the next day, my report appeared with all criticism of the Americans deleted, with all my sources ignored. The Times even carried an editorial suggesting the plot was indeed a suicide attack on the US ship. A subsequent US official report and accounts by US naval officers subsequently proved my dispatch to be correct, except that the Times readers were not allowed to see it. This was when I first made contact with The Independent. I didn't believe in the Times anymore, and certainly not in Rupert Murdoch."
Well, I mean, I think it's not just about what we call phone hacking. Phone hacking used to be called wiretapping. Yeah, what we're talking about is illegal access to people's communications. And Rupert Murdoch doesn't necessarily print everything he finds. What he does is he uses it to blackmail politicians. That's what the worry is that what we got here is a blackmail operation. If you do this and vote for what I want, and for example, B-Sky B, it's obviously where David Cameron's got into trouble here, is around the B-Sky B takeover. Yeah, there's questions about conflict of interest and so on.
Well, another aspect.
He's a personal friend of all of these: Andy Coulson, Rebecca Brooks, Rupert Murdoch, David Cameron are personal friends. They've been meeting. They've met 15 times, I think they've admitted to, since he came to power. And we're talking about personal meetings. Now, is this appropriate for a Prime Minister to be meeting a press baron like this that frequently? And I think that, of course, no minutes were taken in those meetings, so we don't know exactly what was said, and they can tell us anything they like. But nevertheless, it certainly looks, on the face of it, extremely suspicious, doesn't it?
And one other aspect that's come out this week is the incredible number of former News of the World employees and News International employees who were working in the corporate communications department of Scotland Yard. Across Scotland Yard, we're told by the Washington Post, US lawmakers grilling police on a wide variety of UK journalists hired by Scotland Yard. More than a dozen current and former employees of Rupert Murdoch's media empire found work raising questions at Scotland Yard, raising questions about whether the ties were so close that Britain's Premier Police Force shied away from investigating allegations of law-breaking at his now-closed tabloid, The News of the World. Keith Vaz, who's chairman of the Parliamentary Committee questioning police officers on Tuesday about their links to the press, said that officials seem to treat ex-reporters almost like a fashion accessory. Now, it clearly seems problematic if you've got former News of the World people working at Scotland Yard. Neil Wallace, for example, is one senior News of the World journalist arrested last week as part of the police inquiry. Until shortly before his arrest, Wallace was working at a $1,600 a day, that's about £1,000 a day job, advising Scotland Yard on its media strategy. There was also someone who was a Scotland Yard translator who was working for News International at the same time.
Yes, that's very unsavoury, really. It's not a situation that should exist, but if we go back to the connection with politicians, it's a very brave, or should I say, an absolutely crazy politician who deliberately upsets powerful media. You know, I don't know if I would have the guts to do that if I was threatened. Fortunately, I'm not important enough to be in that position.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's what worries me about this. I mean, Rupert Murdoch, both in the United States and Britain, is like a kind of Berlusconi behind the scenes, as it were. He doesn't directly run the country like Berlusconi does in Italy, but you could see in the interrogation that he was getting in Parliament that he was impatient to start. He started banging his fist on the table like Khrushchev, and he thought, yes, I can imagine what you're like in your normal meetings, you know. And it's not necessarily about money. It's about power. Once you're rich enough, you don't need another billion quid, do you? What you're really after is I make and break governments, you know? And this is the overmighty subject. I did history A level. This is the overmighty subject. You know, you think you're bigger than the king. Well, I'm afraid you're not.
Chris, I'll give you the final word on this. How is David Cameron going to sort this out? And is he going to have to resign ultimately, do you think, as part of this?
No, I don't think he needs to resign on this at all.
But he's brought in this guy who certainly now is an alleged criminal mastermind in to run his press operation for 2 years at Downing Street.
Well, as far as I'm aware, he's not actually been found guilty in a court of law.
Well, certainly ex-journalists have accused him directly of organising these operations.
I still think that in this country we still manage to maintain, by and large, the belief that you're innocent until proven guilty. I think David Cameron will get on with doing the job he's doing, and I know that people will try and make more political trouble out of it, if you like, but then that's Westminster for you, and it's not just confined to Westminster. I think he will get over this, and the sooner the better.
Okay, Marina Morris is here. What are you talking about this week, Marina?
Hello, ketamine, drug ketamine. The number of people using the drug ketamine has increased significantly over the last decade in the UK. Bristol is one of the cities where ketamine has become increasingly popular, especially in the mainstream club culture. The Independent Scientific Committee on Drugs cited surveys that in 2009 found some 68% of UK clubbers had taken the drug. Compare this 25% in 2001. The committee said that ketamine's classification in the lowest class C category of control substance wrongly suggested it was less dangerous than ecstasy class A or cannabis class B and underestimates potentially severe harm. Ketamine use can cause bladder problems as well as kidney and liver damage and is especially dangerous when mixed with alcohol, respiratory depressant or antidepressant like Valium. A survey of the street price found the average price of a gram of ketamine has fallen from £30 to £20 between 2005 and 2008 and since become cheaper. One source say about £6 per gram. The British Crime Survey began including ketamine in 2006 and reported an increase in users from about 85,000 in 2006-07 to 113,000 in 2008-09. Professor Nuts of Bristol University ranked drugs by the harm that they cause. Ketamine came sixth behind heroin, cocaine, barbiturates, methadone, and alcohol, but more harmful than, for example, tobacco, LSD, ecstasy, or cannabis. A Bristol mother whose son died after becoming addicted to ketamine is calling for the drugs to be upgraded to class B. Shilmo Twoney insists that ketamine was a significant factor in the death of her son Caleb. Her MP, Charlotte Leslie, supports this and has table and early day motion on the issue. She is currently trying to gain the support of more MPs. A reclassification, however, is unlikely to combat the drug's popularity. Professor of Psychopharmacology at University College London, Val Curell, points out this rarely affects the popularity of a drug amongst users. When people were asked what would change their use of drugs, the two bottom reasons out of 20 suggested were their parents finding out and the classification of the drug. The drug culture is testing us, parents, teachers and children. Something is still missing in our education and value system. The more we tell our children don't, the more exciting the idea becomes. Children's brains are still forming. Drugs can cause addiction and permanent damage. The real answer to inspire children to see a new adventure, set for themselves a vision of their future prospect, and create a desire to win the game of life. If we don't do it, drugs dealers will do it.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Chris Windows, what's your understanding of ketamine, and do you have any dealings with it as a part of your job on the council?
I'm aware of it because of my job on the council, if you like, with community cohesion. It's a very, very difficult problem. I know that it's a difficult problem in Bristol particularly. How you solve this problem, if you upgrade the drug, you make it more expensive.
How do you mean if you upgrade it up to a higher level of danger?
Yes, if you made it...
So a class A rather than
class
a class C.
It then becomes more expensive.
Well, it might.
Probably. And if it becomes more expensive, what's that going to achieve? My own feeling is, and I'm probably not going to have that many people come on board with this, is that we need to have draconian laws on the importation of drugs. There are Eastern countries that have got great big notices as you come into the country, as you come into the airport, saying that it carries a death penalty. Now, I'm not suggesting that we go back to the death penalty, but something very, very draconian, which will be one way of dealing with it. The other way of dealing with it, of course, is to offer them, as we heard just now, an acceptable alternative. Other than that, what can you do? Once people have taken drugs, they don't they're not responsive to what we would call normal argument, if you like.
What about the classification system generally, though? Because cannabis has been being shifted up the system, and there's, as you heard from Marina there, there's a lot of questions over whether a drug which is supposed to be more dangerous because it's a Class A drug or Class B drug rather than a C, whether it really is actually more dangerous. Or do you think actually that there needs to be a completely a new look at this, and the classification system isn't really worth the paper it's written on?
I totally agree with you. I think the whole system needs looking at, the whole classification system, yeah, definitely needs doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think when we talk about drugs, we've got to remember, for example, that Wali Karzai, who was assassinated in Afghanistan last week, the brother of Hamid Karzai, our ally, was the biggest drug dealer in Afghanistan. And our boys are fighting in Afghanistan to protect the regime, which is a major drug dealing regime. There's no doubt about it. The DEA named him as the main drug dealer in the country. He's our ally. Colonel Oliver North in the 1980s, in the Reagan era, Senator Kerry's committee uncovered that he was bringing in massive amounts of cocaine through the MENA Air Base in Arkansas to fund their various activities in Nicaragua, etc. So we've got a situation where the Western intelligence services are up to their necks in drug running. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International was set up as a front for all of this and then eventually crashed. And at the same time, we're arguing about whether kids in Bristol should take ketamine or not take ketamine. Incidentally, on ketamine, it's one of the most uncool drugs I've ever come across. I realised I was middle-aged when I was offered it by some friends of mine, and I thought, no, I'm not doing this, because it makes you lie in the corner dribbling, and you're not going to pick up any girls looking like that. It's really hopeless. And, you know, frankly, it's just uncool, and you should just stay away from it. But the point is, ultimately, that we need to actually have rationality about this. There's a huge drugs industry all over the world. The banking system was rescued by the drug cartels in 2008. There's a UN report on this, a UN report from the Office on Crime and Drugs, and they pointed out that when the banks were in trouble, the cartels went to them and said, you need some money, we've got some. And they just went, yes, thank you very much. So it's absolutely woven into the financial system, the intelligence services, and on the streets. And there's just denial about the reality.
Now, I mean, drugs, surely, Martin,
I'm not suggesting that drugs are good for you.
You're talking about intelligence services, but surely what they do is maybe they're bribed to turn a blind eye, but surely they're
They run it. I mean, the evidence for this is overwhelming. In the Vietnam War, the CIA were encouraging the Hmong tribe to grow.
That was 20, 30 years ago.
No, but they're still doing it. Do you know what happened in January 2009? Two planes crashed in northern Mexico full of cocaine. Where those planes were last seen was on the tarmac at Glasgow Airport, being used in the CIA's secret rendition program. Now, this is the reality of what we're dealing with. And the intelligence services got into the drugs industry in the 40s to try and fight the Chinese communists. They allowed the nationalists to bring heroin into the United States. And this is not conspiracy theory. This is all factual stuff.
If you go back 150 years, weren't we using
The opium wars in the 1840s, where British were selling opium to the Chinese and all the rest of it. There's no... Listen, what we need our young people to realise is that there are a number of options in life, like not taking drugs at all, or taking a little bit, or and they need to know what the options are, and we need to basically legalize and regulate the whole thing and get the mafia out of it. All the dirty money in countries like Mexico and Colombia corrupts everything, and all that dirty money's got to go somewhere. And ultimately, they take the mafia are taking over in these countries. And there's been a report recently by many senior Latin American politicians saying, look, we've just got to change our attitude to this. And you won't stop people from doing it. You won't. Even the only two places where it's ever been stopped completely was when the Chinese communists took over in 1948 in China. They did say, if we catch you with it, we'll execute you. And the same when the Taliban took over in Afghanistan. But that's the only time it's ever happened. And unless we're going to go around executing people in public, so that people see, yes, you touch this stuff, we're going to execute you, I don't think that's rational or possible. So unless you do that, people are going to use drugs, especially now. The society has moved on. People, I mean, in Chris's youth, probably people used to smoke fags behind the bike shed and get drunk underage. Well, now there's all this other stuff to do, and it's just there, and it's not going to go away. And we've got to get rational about it, and we've got to educate people about the dangers.
Okay, yeah? Martin. Now, Chris, I'll just again give you final word on this, because it's quite interesting to hear Martin's sort of paralleling your argument about a quite draconian system with the Chinese communists. But at least it's a system that apparently seemed to work in those days.
Well, all those that were executed no longer took drugs. I mean, we definitely know about that. So in that respect, it did work to a degree.
They were harming themselves.
What about this idea of actually decriminalising it, licensing drugs? Because certainly if you go back to 1920s America and Prohibition, this kind of thing of distilled alcohol over there, the mafia actually loved the fact that Prohibition was on, because it created this black market. And isn't there a similar thing with drugs now?
Yeah, well, thanks for stealing my thunder. I was going to come to that next. In fact, there is a good argument for actually legalising it, taxing it, and treating it in the same way as alcohol, because people will always drink alcohol.
Yes, well, yes, they will. And they abuse it as well.
Yep.
And they
that's
do.
Right, yes. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm not that clever.
No, I think you see, this is what upsets me is Ed Miliband. There was a former minister, I've forgotten the name of the guy now, he was a former Labour minister in Blair's government. He said, well, we've got to have a debate about this, like legalisation, decriminalisation. And immediately Ed Miliband slapped him down and said, no, we're not. And I wasn't very pleased with that. I thought, we need to discuss this openly. Mm. Yeah, we need to have an honest, open discussion, because virtually every family in this country will have somebody, at least one member of their family, who's involved in this one way or another, for sure. And it's about time that we started to, you know, roll our sleeves up and talk about it honestly, rather than, you know, this kind of shouting debate that we have about it. You know, it's all going on. Bristol's got an awful lot of it happening in Bristol. This is a place where we need to discuss it most of all.
Okay, let's move on to a local story. Families make a plea to save day centres from closure. This is in the Evening Post today. Families have urged Bristol City Council to rethink any plans to shut day centres and old people's homes. The authority is looking at closures as a way of releasing up to £20 million to give elderly people and those with learning difficulties more independence. But carers of vulnerable people say the day centres are a lifeline, and the homes provide much needed accommodation for older people, particularly those with dementia. Firm proposals will be revealed in September, but the cabinet councillor in charge here is Dr. John Rogers, began outlining some possible measures earlier in the summer. He's looking at closing 10 homes for the elderly: Bowmead, Brentree, Broomhill, Hayley, Maysknoll and St Peter's, plus Coombe, Rockwell, Wellhay and Greville, which were for elderly people with dementia. The council says these are no longer fit for purpose as the rooms are too small and do not have ensuite facilities. Well, Chris, this is really nail-biting stuff for anyone with families in these places. And also, you know, even if you or I move house, it's quite traumatic for somebody in a fragile elderly state to actually not know where they're going to be living in the future. Is a horrendous thing to do to them.
Yes, I agree. And as far as these closures are concerned, one of them is in my ward, Brentree House. And I was there earlier this week speaking to the staff there about it. I'm very worried about it. I often feel that these moves that are supposed to benefit patients or residents or whatever are more guided by the financial aspect rather than the caring aspect.
But when we're not looking after our old people, people are wondering, why am I bothering to pay my council tax if even the most basic services in our society are starting to crumble?
Well, again, it comes down to the fact that with politics locally, it's a series of priorities. These are certainly
not
my priorities.
So our old people are not a priority, it seems.
Well, of course they are. They're a definite priority to me. I mean, in about 30 years' time, I'll probably be coming to that stage myself.
Only 30?
Shut up, I was waiting for that. Yeah, I just think it's wrong. I mean, I have a great deal of respect for John Rogers. He is a GP in the city. But the thing is, GPs actually refer their patients to these daycare centres. And nobody has yet managed to persuade me that private organisations or the home itself is going to be better than these properly run institutions.
Okay, so can you give us just an idea of what the thoughts were about the staff, patients and family down at Brentree when you were down there earlier in the week?
Yeah, frightened to death. Frightened to death. Some of them angry. And they just don't want it to happen. For one of the things is, as you mentioned earlier, it's so traumatic and so frightening to the elderly people. And it's cruel. It's cruel. And whilst I'm on the subject, I could say as well, it's not just the elderly people that are being affected, but it's the youngsters as well. Our future, if you like, they're having their funding cut considerably. It doesn't matter what people from the ruling party on the council say, they're having their funding cut. They can wrap it up in whatever language they like, but at the end of the day, they're having their funding cut if the cabinet get their own way, and I hope they don't.
But surely, Chris, you mean you're wrapped up with all this, being a Conservative. I mean, these cuts have been sent down from the Conservative coalition at Westminster.
Yes, we've all had cuts, but every authority has its own agenda and its own priorities, and I'm afraid I don't agree with quite a few of the priorities that have been displayed in Bristol.
Martin, is it necessary to shut these day centres, do you think, from an economic point
of view? Well, I mean, there are two levels to this. Obviously, there's a general, you know, have we got enough money with the banking collapse and all the rest of it? But I think John Rogers, I've spoke to John Rogers about this, and we were debating in the streets with an elderly lady who is a resident of one of these homes. And of course, the problem is that as people die off, as it were, there are less and less people in each of these homes. So in actual fact, cost-wise, it's getting more expensive. But of course, for the people who live in that house, that is their home, and they want to live there, and they don't want to be moved from it. And I think John basically doesn't. He thinks of it as a kind of rationalisation, and then things will be better. But he's not seeing the pain that's caused right now by doing this. And I think basically, he wasn't getting very far in persuading Betty that it was a good idea. I'll put it that way.
So who's going to be taking over this kind of service? Is it going to be Southern Cross?
Well, no, there won't be any service at all. I mean, they're talking about getting rid of day centres and people living in their own homes and all the rest of it. I mean, this is a worry. See, the Southern Cross collapse is another example of people, loads of people being all over the country being put in an incredibly scary situation where they don't know whether they're going to be allowed to carry on. And I'm glad to hear Chris saying that properly run things, public sector things, if they're properly run, can be properly run. We should have the ambition to run public things properly. And there's, you know, and if they're not run properly, they should be run properly. And I think you know that there's no particular reason why the private sector is going to do things better, as long as the public sector is properly and effectively managed. And that's got to be done. I mean, we got to aspire to that.
Okay, Chris, I see you nodding there. Now, on to our next story, and the army is to be slashed to its smallest size since the Boer War by the Tory-led coalition. The army will be going round to about 17,000 regular soldiers are being axed in a fresh betrayal, this is according to the Daily Mirror, James Lyons, of our troops that will leave Britain reliant on a dad's army of reservists. The move comes as the death of a British soldier in the hands of an Afghan National Army gunman casts fresh doubt on David Cameron's plans to end the war against the Taliban within 4 years. So 17,000 less soldiers. Is this a good idea? Does this mean we're moving to become a more peaceful nation, Chris?
Well, we won't have a lot of option the way it's being, the way the cuts are going as far as the military is concerned. We have to decide if we want to carry on pretending to be one of the police forces of the world, or whether we want to acknowledge the fact that we can't afford to do this anymore. And it's a case of choice, but it does worry me a little bit. If you remember back in the 30s when there were so many cuts, and then what happened in 1939, we must maintain our own security. And I know that warfare has changed considerably, from large numbers of people to very sophisticated equipment, but it does seem draconian to me. I would be happier if it didn't happen.
It was cutting 17,000 soldiers. Well, I mean, this is amazing that this should happen from a Conservative government, because surely if Labour were to have done it before, you know, the Conservatives and David Cameron would have had Gordon Brown's guts for garters.
Yes, yeah, so I was just thinking about the expression you used.
It's a bit quaint.
Yes.
Quaint. Shows your age, Tony.
Yes, but what you take the point that this is something that that you would have thought that if anything like this would have happened during the previous government, then the Conservatives would have been absolutely stamping their feet and probably shooting their guns in the air if they had them.
Well, to a degree, the job of the opposition is to really, if you like, hold the government of the day to account. And if you have a very weak opposition with a strong government, then things start to go pear-shaped.
So, Martin, what's your thoughts on this story? The Boer War, the army is going to be the smallest size since the Boer War.
Well, that's going back a bit, isn't it? Let's face it. I think one of the problems is the inter-service rivalries between the Air Force, the Navy and the Army. And I was an aid worker in Bosnia in the 90s. I had to work with the British Army, and I thought they did a pretty good job, actually. And my vision for the future of the British Army would be doing more jobs like that. And to do those jobs, you need well-trained infantry to do what you might call peacekeeping duties, like in Sierra Leone or Bosnia, which I think were the most useful jobs they've done in recent years. And you don't actually need loads. I mean, if you want to invade people's countries and steal their oil, then you need huge kind of aircraft carriers and all the rest of it, because you're going to bomb the hell out of them and then march in there with your tanks and all the rest of it. But if you are actually a crack peacekeeping force, what you need is really well-trained infantry. So in actual fact, I think this is going in the wrong direction.
So, Chris, do you think it's wise for Mr. Cameron to pick a fight with the army?
I don't think it's wise for him to pick a fight with anybody, really, but he's obviously got more information about this than I have, but at this moment in time I am unhappy, shall we say, about what I see as the cutback on our forces.
And next story, police forces are to cut more than 34,000 officers and staff. A Manchester Inspectorate of Constabulary report says 10% reduction in officers will lead to a 3% rise in crime. This is in The Guardian. Police forces in England and Wales plan to cut 34,100 officers and staff over the next few years in a move that will trigger a fresh rise in crime. First reliable estimate by Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary is far higher than the previous claims of 28,000, which were made a few months ago. So this is 43 police forces planning to cut 16,200 officers. Chris, is this really a Conservative policy?
Well, obviously, the Conservatives are in government at the moment. I think there's more to this than meets the eye. I think that there should be a change in the way the police forces are actually used at this moment in time. They seem to be used to a considerable amount, actually writing reports and filling out paperwork. And I know there's been it's been cut down a bit, but it needs to be cut down an awful lot more, and allow the policemen to go out on the street where people actually expect to see them.
The Home Office Minister, James Brokenshire, insisted that the effectiveness of a police force did not depend on its total numbers, but on how well it used its resources.
I got that right then.
Yeah, but it's the sort of thing that you can say very easily and very hard to do. I think ultimately, I think that we've got to talk about whether the cuts are a sensible policy, full stop. I don't think that cutting is actually going to help us. We're going to end up in the same position as Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, etc., because that's what cuts do to you. So I wish the Labour front bench would be stronger about saying, look, cutting things is not the way forward. But second, of course, is that the police in Bristol, we had the so-called Tesco riot the other week, so we've covered extensively on this programme, but that was outside forces coming into Bristol and actually behaving rather badly, whereas the local police in Bristol, by and large, are well-known and well-liked within the community. And I think my uncle was a police officer years ago in Birmingham, and this whole idea of arresting more people means you're doing a better job misses the point. The police are there to keep the peace. They should arrest people as a final resort, and they should have all sorts of other tricks up their sleeve to make sure that people behave themselves. And there shouldn't be a tick box culture of you've got to go around and arrest as many people
but
as possible.
Isn't there
That's
a danger
silly.
That in a recession people are more tempted to be
indeed,
naughty?
The problem is, you see, that as we go into a mass unemployment scenario, people are more. I mean, it's as night follows day, burglaries and all that other stuff goes up, and then of course the police numbers are going down. And the problem we will find, for example, in the United States of America, as people run out of unemployment benefits, 3.7 million people are about to run out of unemployment benefits, they've all got guns, and they'll just go down to the shop and get what they need. And then, of course, you get into a really dangerous breakdown of civil order.
Yeah, I'd like to come in there and say, whilst I agree with quite a lot of what you've just said, I'd like to bring us back more locally and say that in my ward, that was in the news a couple of years back for antisocial behaviour, quite serious antisocial behaviour, particularly in the Crow Lane area of Henbury. That report was given by the police when I met with the police the other day, that it had actually, antisocial behaviour and petty crime had actually been reduced by 64%.
Yeah.
And I think that's brilliant. And it's mainly the police, but it's also the community working with the police.
That's right.
And that's how it ought to be.
Well, on Stokes Croft, where we had the so-called riot the other week, I mean, we've covered all the background of that in other programmes.
And will be in future.
And will be in future, because we're still not happy with the police's explanation of what happened, but the petty crime and theft has fallen by 50% there in the last year. And it's actually the community and the police working together which does this.
Exactly.
Because you isolate, it's a small number of people who make most of the trouble in Bristol. Yeah, the police know who they are. They're a handful. And if we isolate them, then they're isolated, aren't they?
But isn't this almost going to be like boom time for crime as the recession kicks in?
Well, potentially, yes. But we don't give up just because there's a crash and a crisis. We don't give up enforcing the law. Although I would imagine that the police are not going to have a big priority on arresting people for smoking cannabis in their front rooms, you know, as long as they're not causing bother to their neighbours.
So isn't there a little bit of a concerning trend here, Chris, with the massive cutdowns in the army and the police force? These don't seem to me... sound to me like conservative policies.
I think they're forced on the government, whichever government was in place. I think that it would have to make a lot of these swinging cuts. Now, where they made the cuts would depend upon their priorities according to the party, but cuts would definitely have to be made.
I don't agree.
Okay, well, thanks to this week's guest. That was Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. After the news, with the death on Monday of Sean Hoare, the key witness against the Prime Minister's former press secretary, we ask, is there a death squad stalking Britain?
Boys, and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
From the Sky News Centre...